Hi, everyone. My name is Dr. Deb Roberts, and I am the host for Season 2 of the Mind Medicine Australia's podcast. Before we begin with this week's guest, a reminder that Mind Medicine Australia's focus is on the development and the use of evidence-based psychedelic-assisted therapies within regulated healthcare systems. We do not, though, encourage the use of psychedelic medicines outside of this context, and we do not support the use of these substances in any way that is unlawful. This podcast is intended for educational purposes only. None of the content herein constitutes medical advice. Guests' views are their own and do not represent the views of Mind Medicine Australia, and individuals need to discuss their individual healthcare needs with their healthcare providers. Thank you for listening. Well, welcome to the Mind Medicine Australia podcast, Dr. Ted Cassidy. Thank you for coming on to the program today.
Thank you for inviting me, Deborah. It's a pleasure.
We have started these sessions each time, just taking about 30 seconds. As long as listeners are not driving, they can choose to do this little exercise. But it also is just an opportunity to ground. And so I tend to have take either shoes off or feet flat on the ground just to feel a little bit of the stability that at least at the moment is beneath us. And from that sense of stability, there is an opportunity to engage with a more subtle layer of the breath, and also close the eyes if that serves you or is accessible. And sometimes allowing just the breath out, the exhale, to be a focus. It allows us to rid any residue that we can polish off. And then just taking another cleansing exhale and then an inhale when you are ready. And just letting the eyes flutter open. Sometimes we can have a little bit more clarity and kind of rid the peripheral when we do that. So thank you for joining me in that, Ted. We're going to hear that some of your background in a moment, but a question I've been asking, which has been generally open-ended, but asking just for this, for where you are at the moment, and there's no right or wrong answer, of course. You're a psychiatrist, so you'll be able to also know this perhaps line of questioning, but is just wanted to know what you feel connected to at the moment.
I've always been, at a personal and professional level, they're quite different, I guess, but they do interrelate. At a professional level, I'm very committed to the issues of treatment resistance in depression, anxiety, PTSD. I mean, everyone comes with their own personal story with these things, and my personal story really relates to my early childhood when I developed cancer at the age of 10 years old, which was a really kind of major diagnosis. At that stage, I was diagnosed in 1980. I'm now 54, and I had a cancer on my face, and it was a life-threatening cancer. In the years before that, the death rate was something like 90%, in the 1970s. So most kids who got this died. And certainly, you know, when I was in the hospital wards at that stage, you know, I saw other people, you know, with similar cancers that were losing legs and dying. And so this obviously has a major impact. And there were really two things that it really did for me. First of all, I mean, was a consideration which has really only continued over the course of my life of the impact this had on my parents, the impact it had on my brother and sister, and the way these kind of conditions kind of flow on into mental health issues. In particular, seeing the effect on my parents, both handled it very differently. My father certainly became quite depressed, you know, from a guy who was, you know, a really capable guy, and subsequently was very capable as well, but really struggled for a number of years with, you know, issues of loss and sense and, you know, what's happening to his older son. So that's the first thing. It gave me a really deep appreciation of, what it means to sort of have mental health issues, what it means to cope with grief, and how people get through it. Because ultimately, both my parents did get through it and had very, one of them were very good parents and had a very good life. The other thing that it really gave me a sense of is just how important innovation is in healthcare in general. In the period leading up to my diagnosis, 90% of kids died. But in the very early 80s, new treatment approaches, multimodal treatments for that particular childhood cancer were developed. And I was very lucky to be at the Children's Hospital at the time, which was one of the early adopters of those treatments. And we saw, death rates go from 90% mortality going down to 10%. So I was, and I was in the very first wave of people that benefited from that. The impact of mental health, but also the importance of innovation in health and how important it is for doctors and professionals that are charged with the care of people to actually, be on the ball, to be open to new approaches, to doing things differently. And that has very real impacts on people's life. I think I think they're probably two things. And then as it led into my professional life, look, to be honest, I never really in any conscious way during my medical student days planned to be a psychiatrist. I had a whole range of other interests, but I sort of found myself, as an intern registrar thinking, well, I've tried a bunch of things. I'm not really that interested in some of these things. And I'd always been quite good at sort of all the sort of psychology, behavioral science subjects at university. I never really put much weight into that, but it sort of came a bit easier. And I just found myself in a psychiatry term with a really good group of people at Concord Hospital in Sydney, and it just clicked. I loved it. I loved what I was doing. I had really sort of good mentors and teachers, I've had a lot of luck in my life, and one of the pieces of luck that I had was finding myself, in the right job at the right time and getting the right experiences. That's kind of been, how I got into healthcare. And then really, I'm a bit of a nonconformist by nature. So, once I graduated, I wasn't really going to follow the path that people sent me to. So, I had a number of interests. The first half of my 20-year career as a psychiatrist was devoted towards, a large group practice in northwestern Sydney called the Hills Clinic. And myself and my business partner at the time, who was also a psychiatrist, we set up, a big sort of multidisciplinary practice. At that stage, going back 20 years, it was quite unusual to have psychiatrists and psychologists working together, but we sort of brought in psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers. We'd had one of the first multidisciplinary practices, which we developed into a private hospital in the northwest, and we did all the kind of work of building that up ourselves, and we ultimately sold that. And then about sort of, about 10 years ago, the second half of my career, I had really, during that first half, really grappled with the idea of depression, patients with depression, anxiety, and PTSD, and the level of treatment resistance. It was very clear to me that a big chunk of the work of particularly private mental health, non sort of public hospital mental health, was really dealing with people that don't get better. And that's about half the people, maybe not quite half, but it's a very large number of people with these very common diagnoses that just don't get better, and so you end up in this holding pattern. So everything I've done since then has been about, well, how do we combine this idea of outpatient treatment? I really like that because outpatient treatment is about function and keeping people functional, and I like that over inpatient treatment where you're kind of defunctioning people. So I like keeping people connected with their job and their family and their hobbies and their activities and their sense of personal achievement, but also combining that with what are the innovative approaches. I mean, a lot of people are very satisfied just writing a script for an antidepressant or sending them off to their favorite psychologist, and I think those are really good first steps. But I think for half the people they don't work for, and everything I've done since then has been about other treatments. So I founded Monarch Mental Health with Professor Fitzgerald. At that stage, we focused very much on transcranial magnetic stimulation, which was an outpatient treatment that was, effective for depression. And, you know, we were able to really help, you know, half to two thirds of those non-responders. And we're still now the largest outpatient provider of TMS care in Australia. But it's always been clear, every new treatment, there are non-responders. You know, you do need to be open to innovation. Innovation doesn't stop because you've done something and you've moved on. So, you know, we're involved in transcranial direct current stimulation, you know, esketamine, ketamine therapy. And then about 4 or 5 years ago, this is into my journey into, I suppose, psychedelics. I'm very unusual in the psychedelic community. I have no particular interest in psychedelics. I never used drugs recreationally. I wasn't really interested in psilocybin or MDMA. I kind of perhaps had a bunch of embedded prejudices, you know, even before I started this journey. And I was fortunate enough to meet Peter Hunt, who's obviously one of the co-founders of Mind Medicine Australia. I met him about 5 years ago. And at that stage, I don't think he'd actually founded Mind Medicine. He and Tanya hadn't founded Mind Medicine Australia. And he was really just talking to psychiatrists that he'd heard were interested in innovation, asking their ideas. And when he mentioned this idea of psychedelics, I thought, oh my God, this is like a crazy idea. So it'll be 100 years before this happens. And but nevertheless, Peter, by his, you know, is a really sensible guy. And he wasn't my image of what someone who was pro-psychedelic was. And so it really encouraged me to actually start looking at some of the data and some of the ideas around it. And what I found was a treatment that combined, you know, safety, because I think that was very high on my agenda, potential efficacy, an outpatient treatment, and also the potential to actually, you know, have dramatic improvements in patient care. So it sort of fitted very much into the interest that I had. And the more I started looking into it, the more interested I was. But I guess I, you know, if I look at the psychedelic community out there, there seems to be, you know, there seems to, there's probably more strands, but there seem to be two kind of themes that run out. There's psychedelics as well-being and I suppose improving quality of life, and then there's psychedelics as treatment. Even today, I'm very much in the psychedelics as treatment group. And you know, I'm an authorized prescriber of psilocybin for treatment-resistant depression, and an authorized prescriber of MDMA for PTSD. And that's really my interest in those. Other than that, what are my interests? I think, you know, I have a family, I have a wife, I have an 8-year-old daughter and an 18-year-old daughter. As you know, I try and as I'm getting in, I'm now 54, so I'm kind of very much trying to, you know, balance, you know, doing things that I know are going to be good for me personally, you know, investing in my family and friends and lifestyle with doing meaningful work. And as my wife says to me, if I ever whinge about work, I say, well, I'm sick of this, so it's too much work, I'll just do less. And she says, well, you actually won't be happy. You know, if you're doing nothing, you'll be the most miserable guy ever. And I think she's probably right, because, you know, you do need a sense of purpose in life. And you know, work, you know, gives a tremendous sense of purpose, and we do good stuff, and it's interesting work. So I like
I
work.
remember it just it dawned on me that you know, someone said, I think it was like on ABC radio or something, but of saying, you know, really only need three things in life: someone that you love, someone that loves you, and something of, you know, doing something of purpose. And you know, it wouldn't it be nice to, you know, if it was as simple as that. And that was the, when I asked you about connection, it's something I've asked everyone up front, because in my experience, I came to be doing these, you know, the hosting of this podcast solely because my sister had ended her life in America, Stephanie, about 14 months ago. And at the time, she had had a long history with mental illness, and trying everything, including, TMS and most other, but she hadn't tried. We were looking at the use of psychedelics at the time, and in America, different from Australia, at the time it was Oregon and Colorado that were potentially going to be the earliest takers of that. And so we were exploring that at the time, and unfortunate for my sister, it wasn't something that she was able to access, or even the efficacy in her mind of where things were at. So she actually didn't have connection. So this notion of connection, some people find it annoying even to talk about. I keep talking about it, because what do we really mean by that? In terms of staying connected, and that why I asked that question, because when we're not connected to anything, people, even if it's animals, our place of, where even our home, whatever it might be, community, work, as we retreat, or as people retreat, often in pe with people with both what you mentioned with PTSD and treatment-resistant depression, addiction, all, other diagnoses, et cetera, which I want to, tease out a little bit more with you in this conversation. But, it's how do we remain connected. My sister was connected at a certain time. She had a beautiful family. As we know, it cuts through, all races, creeds, socioeconomic status, et cetera. And I think we both are in agreement that it's, there's some big issues. They talk about it now. 42 or 43%, half of people, half of the population, at least in the Western world, having a diagnosis in their lifetime. I think that's ABS statistics. Happy to kind of what your thoughts are on that. But if half the population are, having a diagnosis of either depression or anxiety as the two largest proportions, you kind of wonder, gosh, if half of our population has this, is it actually a disorder? So I wonder, yeah, just I know that just in in what your thoughts are around the diagnostic aspect, and then of course we're going to get into the some of the experience of you treating people as one of the first psychiatrists in Australia to do so under this new approval.
I think this sort of this idea of connection sort of dovetails in well with kind of one of the things that I think is probably the most real thing in mental health. I mean, people, and I think that's function, actually. I think function is the most important thing in mental health, and has numerous advantages. Probably the most important of which is it's probably the only thing that people agree on. It's something that is quite objective, and it may not just be function as in how many hours of work you do, but it's function in terms of how you're coping in terms of your relationship, how you're coping in terms of your sort of non-paid sort of activities, a whole range of things, your day-to-day functioning, your ability to look after yourself, your ability to enjoy and interact with life. But generally, we can actually agree on it because it's what you're doing, across a whole bunch of domains. And I think that's a much more valuable, for me as a psychiatrist over the last 20 years, that's been the most important measure I've had of a patient. Diagnosis is very much secondary. And the reason I say that is because I do understand that diagnosis is important, and it tends to be quite categorical, and some of those categories kind of lack a bit of logic as well. And you only have to talk to people that were on the sort of various committees for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Diseases. They don't talk about these things as the diseases. They say these were really just statistical aggregations of symptoms that we found that they sort of clustered together, and for the purposes of insurance companies and getting rebates, we kind of had to use them, and we've kind of adopted that in mental health because we have nothing better, and that's what we're stuck with, and it's important because if you're a psychiatrist or a psychologist and you're working with people, often the funding and the rules of what you can use and how you can use it is very much dependent on your ability to make that diagnosis. The important thing that I've noticed is that these kind of diagnostic categories are frequently there's frequent levels of different disagreement between psychiatrists, between psychologists. You see the mental health professionals, they all kind of see something differently. So yes, they're important, but function, I think, is probably the most powerful thing because there is a large amount of agreement and objectivity about that. And if you're actually putting in place interventions, then a really good measure of your success or failure is what have been the changes in the level of function. And I think that the way I think about function is very much what you're thinking about in terms of connectedness. Clearly, someone who's withdrawing, someone who's not working, who's not seeing their family, is doing less, is more isolated, that's really indicative of a declining level of function. Whereas if you can start, maybe people don't feel necessarily a lot better, but if they're doing more and they're connected more, that's a very good sign. One of the things we know from some of the occupational rehab and the sort of the workers' comp sort of world, is they say that once your function has declined for a period of time, the likelihood of ever getting back that function starts to reduce dramatically. In fact, workers' comp claims, the people that sort of do workers' compensation insurance, they say once you've been out of work for more than 12 months, the chance of actually getting back to full-time work is almost zero. And that is a very expensive claim for them. But what they're saying is that lack of function actually creates more lack of function. And that's why I think function is really important. And that has always been throughout my career, one of my frustrations with my colleagues and the way the mental health system works is because it's mental health, there's a real lack of urgency about it. They say, well, people have been depressed, they're depressed, it's not, they're not going to die. So, what's the issue? Well, firstly, they do die, as you found with your sister and I found with an uncle, people do commit suicide, and it's an absolute tragedy, the impact that it lay obviously on their life, but also on the lives of everyone around them. So they do die. The second thing is, even if they don't die, what are the losses? You've lost a parent, you've lost a valuable worker, you've lost a contributor to a community. I mean, the losses are absolutely enormous. And if someone's been not functioning for a year, they're never going to get back that function. And the analogy that I often use is around, holidays. So anyone who's taken a holiday for, a long service, when they've been on holidays for 8 weeks or 3 months or something, you come back to work at the end of that, and it takes you a week or two to get back into work. Now, actually, been away for 2 or 3 months, you've had a wonderful holiday, you're feeling rested and rejuvenated, yet the process of coming back to work requires some adjustment and is difficult for a period of time. Now, if you then say, well, actually, I had, 6 months off or 12 months off, I had an absolutely miserable time, I spent a time in hospital, I maybe lost my partner, I'm now living in reduced financial circumstances, and I've got my self-esteem's been knocked about, how likely is it that you're going to turn back up to work and not have a massive adjustment? And if that adjustment's too big, you probably won't go back to work. You probably won't have another go at a relationship. There's a whole bunch of things you won't do. So, mental health is an emergency. The emergency is time. And it's really important when you see someone who's depressed or has PTSD or has anxiety that you're quick with your treatments. You don't leave someone sitting on an antidepressant for 6 months. You change them up, you get them to maximum doses, you be aggressive in your treatment over a short period of time. When those treatments don't work, you start to think of next step treatments. You look at your magnetic stimulation or your psychedelics or your ketamines or your kind of more intensive treatments with respect to psychology or psychiatry. That's the sort of thing we should be doing, because yes, there will be people that don't respond and are unwell for very long periods of time, but we want to minimize that group as much as possible. And that's why I'm interested in psychedelics. Not because I think they're going to help every single patient, or they should be used in every single patient, but for the proportion of patients that are non-responding, for which we've tried a bunch of other things, this is an option that we should explore. Unless there are safety considerations, we should be doing this because it's an emergency, because the alternative is doing nothing. And if we do nothing, then we've basically given up on patients. And I think that is not acceptable. It's not acceptable for the patient and their family, where keeping a sense of hope for the future is absolutely critical. And it's not really acceptable for the doctors either. I mean, I couldn't think of nothing more dispiriting than just seeing the same patient year after year, writing the same script for antidepressants, and seeing them half well That's the recipe for a really unpleasant career. And I and a lot of my colleagues that burn out after 10 or 15 years in private practice, that's exactly what they say. They just got sick of seeing the same people over and over again, and they didn't feel they were getting anywhere. So on a whole bunch of levels, we need to actually be open to new things. Psychedelics, I think, is one of those things, and it's pretty exciting. And I've been.
Yeah, I think that the, going back to, I want to talk about innovation again. Obviously, psychedelic assisted therapy being one of them. Isn't it funny though that it's an innovation? It's been around for, so long, and in many societies, part of the fabric of perhaps what keeps people evolving. But anyway, I will come back to the innovation. I think that it's always easier to, even when I said communicated about my own sister and reasoning to, get that interested in this area. I haven't had an experience with psychedelic therapy myself, although I potentially would. And I mention it only because when you were talking about an outpatient program, like, mental, what would be called illness, has played a big part in our family, in my family's, history. Like many families, I don't think you get a family without something, especially with the statistics being almost half for some of these conditions, if they are conditions. But I have been in your comment around the outpatient aspect. I have had my own, six different residential facility experiences myself in, I'm 50 now, in my own experience, and also so many of those different treatments. Probably, I don't know, since 18, possibly even 20 different combinations, of antidepressants over the years. I had 15 years with a, psychiatrist year after year. Wonderful. She was a great psychiatrist. I didn't, within that time, I, did have a few inpatient stints and change treatments, et cetera. And I bring it up because so many of, like the, whatever it might be, TMS, EMDR, people can look, there's so many different, DBT, CBT, the, talking therapy, all the different, kind of tools in the, toolkit that fit for some and not others. ECT, my sister, both in, we had experienced that. But yet, in many ways, I'm combining the two of us for a moment, but really only to almost second what you were saying, in the sense of don't give up of the potential to have some circuit breaker on, of some, in some people, with the 6 weeks of being on an antidepressant, it takes that time. And, but yet you don't stop at that. But, I think what's challenging from the user's point of view is that's a, it's a lot of treatments, and if we can get to something, where I say on put, out loud, the point of this podcast isn't to say that the psychedelics is the answer to everyone, and you have already mentioned that. But I want to, the notion of hope, and really making a dent in, I would even, I mean, my sister obviously passed, but in my own experience from age 14 and now I'm 50, it's a long history of having, significant challenges. And so I wonder if you want to communicate to the listeners and myself as well of just your experience. You have had a few patients come through, or at least if you don't mind sharing some of that experience, maybe from, yeah, whatever you feel you're happy to share, maybe from your clinical background and also just other observations, if you're happy to share with us.
I think, I mean, there's, I mean, I can talk about some of the stuff pre-psychedelics, but I think, we obviously do want to get to the psychedelic. So in terms of, Monarch and their sort of engagement with patients in relation to psychedelic assisted therapy, it really came in two parts. The first part was through our research institute, and prior to the TGA decision, we'd had a number of clinical trials going within the psychedelic space, and probably the main one that I think is really important, and which we do with some funding through Mind Medicine Australia, is the ASSESS clinical trial, which is looking at giving, offering an experience of either MDMA or psilocybin to clinicians that are working in the area of psychedelic-assisted therapy, so that they, and then we take a whole bunch of kind of physical measures on them. So it's really looking at a healthy person and what the impact of either MDMA or psilocybin has on them. That's the substance of the trial. I suppose the practical aspect of the trial is one of the big things in the psychedelic community is, have you had a psychedelic experience yourself? I've got my views probably a little bit contrary on that, but in any case, it is a big deal, and I think where clinicians can, by being participants in this trial, have the opportunity to either experience what it feels like to be on MDMA or psilocybin, and then integrate that experience into their practice as
Okay,
therapists.
so it's a healthy person's trial. It was a healthy, yes, that's right.
So that's we've done a, we've got another a number of other trials looking at sort of more clinical situations of the use of psychedelics, in OCD or depression, looking at that. But that's one that I think interacts with a lot of with the therapist community, and also sort of goes to what Monash and My Medicine Australia have been doing together. So I think that's important. But then that led very much in, once the TGA decision came into, say, well, what does a clinical program look like? And we were really well positioned, I think, in terms of getting a clinical program together, because we'd been doing the research. So we already had developed protocols, we'd submitted things to ethics committee, and as it turned out, the whole process of becoming an authorized prescriber and being able to offer it clinically is very similar to what it takes to actually get a clinical trial approved. So,
Yes.
we were able to sort of put a submission together reasonably soon. I was an authorized prescriber by, I think, early November, and certainly one of the earliest prescribers. And then we were able to have our first, and start enrolling patients in December, and have our first patient have a dosing session in January. One of the first in the world, and treatment. So that was really exciting. If we look at the sort of types of patients we're getting, it's kind of interesting. It's not exactly what I was expecting. I kind of was thinking, because there's so much treatment-resistant depression out there, I thought, the main interest would be depression. But we're probably getting 2 out of 3 patients have PTSD. And again, even within that group of 2 out of 3, it's not exactly what I'd expect. I was expecting it to be more kind of the traditional kind of military, police, first responder trauma, which is very male dominated, and but it hasn't been. It's probably been about 2/3 women, 1/3, and that group around women is more sort of around developmental, domestic violence, sexual assault trauma. So that seems to be the group that, is the predominant group within our PTSD group. That PTSD group definitely dominates over the psilocybin depression group. And during the assessment, so once that's the actual, just I suppose people just picking up the phone and ringing us about it. When we actually start doing assessments, it's still fairly pronounced. I mean, in many ways, the patients that we're assessing for MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD, they're a much more straightforward group. So they tend to be progressing through the assessment a lot quicker and getting into treatment. And for whatever reason, I don't really know, within the psilocybin group, there just seems to be, more issues in terms of their suitability. And again, these are not kind of massive samples we're talking about, but certainly in our experience, there've been kind of more physical kind of contraindications. There's been more sort of psychological indications. There's been more sort of issues around, just logistics about getting people there, funding, all those sorts of things. It's just more difficult in that group. I don't know what that means, and maybe if you talk to me in a year's time, it'll all kind of rebalance. But certainly in the first sort of 3 months of offering this program, as I said, 2/3 PTSD, 1/3 depression.
Did you do you mean also that with the screening, et cetera, that the more people are not going, they're not able to end up having the dosage because of the screening process?
Yeah, so in terms of people that come for with PTSD wanting to progress to MDMA-assisted therapy, a lot of those people are getting through.
Yes.
The people that ring up and mostly end up being suitable, whereas our experience has been the reverse with with treatment-resistant depression and psilocybin, most of them have been unsuitable. And
Unsuitable.
there really isn't a theme to it. You know, some of the stuff, like, they're just too far away, or they can't organize transport and all those. So you'd think they've got nothing to do with the diagnosis. But it just seems that there are more of those issues with treatment-resistant depression than there are with MDMA, where people are similarly coming from long distances but seem to be able to want
To
to
do.
work.
Oh, well, I mean, it's, as you said, it is the, you know, if we're looking at January having started and you were, you know, one of the first, you know, and it, the TGA approval was, you know, July, you know, last year. It does show how innovations and so forth, it's the, it's, there's so many different, aspects that, yeah, just are challenging. And, you know, it may be, as you say, it'll be interesting to see. I wonder if that mirrors the kind of the research internationally in terms of that patterning. But I guess it doesn't really matter at the moment. It's about getting the right people.
I think the difficulty with the research is the studies that are out there are massively oversubscribed. So you regularly get stories that, you know, there's, you know, 100 or 200 applicants for every participant position there is in a clinical trial. So
Wow.
it's very difficult to get a sense of what the real world is.
Yeah, but it's a really important point. If what you're saying is there is that 100 or 200 people per one that actually,
Yes.
you know, that gets in. I mean, it also shows not just how oversubscribed it is, but just how much of an emergency, you know, this really is.
The other thing, sort of just sort of cycling back to the beginning of your question, so that's what, you know, it's looked like in terms of getting into the program and the background of the programs that we're offering at Monarch, and just talking to the people that are also interested in it. I don't think anyone else has actually got a program that's kind of running as a program at the moment. But, you know, this is not an uncommon discussion amongst the people that are starting to think about assessments. I think the other thing, going back, you know, what's the sort of journey? You know, a lot of patients have very chronic problems over 10 or 20 years. And this is not just for psychedelic, but for any kind of next step treatment. What I find is, when people say, look, I've been unwell for 10 years or 15 years or 20 years, and I've been on 15 or 20 different tablets, and maybe had some hospital admissions and psychologists. One of the frustrating things for me is that even though they've been unwell for such a long period of time, no one's ever done anything different. And I think patients don't realize how similar a lot of the medications are. So if you've been on 10 or 15 conventional antidepressants, you've essentially been on the same drug the whole time. And, you know, because pretty well every antidepressant is basically a serotonin increasing drug, maybe more, maybe less. Some of them have little tweaks, but they're all essentially very, very similar. So, you know, one of the kind of really formative kind of studies, you know, from, you know, the STAR*D trial from the early 2000s, really kind of said it all. It basically says your very first antidepressant that you try, if you know, you've got like your kind of 60% response rate, 40% non-response. If you go on a second antidepressant after you've non-responded, your response rate's halved. If you go on a third, they halve again, and that sort of halving keeps on going down. So what it's basically saying is that if something doesn't work, and then you do something very similar, it probably won't work either. And if you keep on selecting yourself into the not working with similar things group, you're probably not going to respond. So you're kind of all we really do, you know, with this multiple antidepressant changes and failures, and, you know, certainly once you've got past two or three antidepressants, all you're really doing is just confirming that it doesn't work. You know, people don't realize this. And that's why I was so passionate about next step treatments, is because whether it's psychedelics, whether it's magnetic stimulation, whether it's S-ketamine, you know, whether it's TDCS, these are all different treatments. They're
What was the
different,
last one you said, Ted?
only your direct current stimulation. So a sort of a wearable sort of device that you can do at home.
Oh,
And really,
right.
there's other stuff that people do. My point is, though, that they're different. They have different modes of action. ECT has a different mode of action to an antidepressant. So these very different treatments really mean that what happened before doesn't matter. So when someone says, I've been unwell for 15 years, and then I find they've been on 10 or 15 antidepressants that are the same. Really, that doesn't say anything about treatment resistance, really. I mean, it meets the technical definition. But all I've said is that something didn't work 15 years ago, and I've never done anything different. So, yeah, but if I do something different, maybe it will work. And that's what we found with magnetic stimulation treatment, that, the people, when you just tried doing something different, it actually worked for, two-thirds of them. And that, I'm sure that's what's going to happen when we with psilocybin and with MDMA, that we're going to find that because this is such a radical different treatment that has different mode of action and is in no way similar to antidepressant medicines or magnetic stimulation or whatever else hasn't worked before, that we're going to find a proportion of these people work simply because it's different.
Would you say, though, Ted, that the in terms of I'm just thinking I came to the Australia in 1995, so around that period of time, that most people were that is what the line of treatment was. Yes, there was DBT and CBT and talking therapies, but then in the last kind of 10 years, I know that TMS and EMDR and ketamine and these other and psychedelics in terms of coming to the coming to the table. But most prior to that, that is what either mood stabilizers or a combination. And even now, I'm happy to, like it was, a stint of EMT that did something for me. But I wanted to get to the longevity. That didn't then change everything. The idea still is a regular, being on some, some kind of medication, if you go down that pharmaceutical lane in combination with other treatments. And I wondered what your thoughts are in terms of, I know with the standards needing to be off potential antidepressants or mood stabilizers, and in the kind of just the depression category, because that's what we're talking about here, not others. What are your thoughts in terms of people staying on the medication as opposed to getting off of it in that screening process? And just to let everyone know, there's the screening process before you can, as Ted said, come on to the for the treatment. And one of the issues for people on medication is to get be getting off that at a time when you're not particularly functioning well. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, and that's difficult. And look, it is just a straight sort of drug interaction. So you can't use virtually any of the conventional antidepressants are kind of can't be on board when you're having either MDMA or psilocybin
And it's
because
about 6 weeks, isn't it? What is that the?
it depends. You can probably get away with 3 to 4 weeks, but let's say
Okay.
certain
It's just
antidepressants.
tricky. I was wondering what you're th so what you're saying is it's not a debate, so to speak. Well,
Exactly.
it's a debate, but you're saying they go against one
Yeah,
another, or they're at the same
it's just a physically dangerous thing to do. So
physically.
it is unfortunately something that has to be managed,
Okay.
And so we're coming into it. Now there are ways of doing it. So not, antidepressants, particularly the serotonin increasing antidepressants, they're kind of an absolute contraindication. So you have to have them, means you can't be on them.
Yes.
Certainly help manage people's getting them off these medications in a slow way to minimize side effects. We can use certain drugs like the benzodiazepines or even some of the antipsychotics to help manage symptoms. The really interesting uses of magnetic stimulation treatment that I've found is because there's no drug interaction, it's a non-drug treatment, you can use that as coverage. So if you've got someone who's not coping in the kind of couple of months leading up to their first dosing session because they've got a relapse of their depression or
Yeah,
people
interesting.
use magnetic stimulation in a fairly safe way. So there are ways of managing that, but it is actually one of the challenges, and it's, how do we manage this? And that's.
And bringing that up, I know is a technicality where there's so much obviously we can communicate about. I wondered what your thoughts or what some of your observations, either in the dosing sessions themselves with the people that have come through, any observations and or the integration after it, that I suspect is part of your part of the Monarch's treatment.
So in terms of we've got three patients that are currently kind of in the process, and we've got probably another 15 or 20 that are sort of partway through the assessment. So we've got three patients who are in the process. All of them have PTSD. Two of them have kind of sort of a sexual assault, domestic violence-based PTSD, and the other has a kind of more first responder PTSD. We've completed one patient, again, it was almost like a textbook positive case. So it was actually, this patient was probably the best patient to have as a first patient. Did really well, significant improvement in symptoms. All our rating scales have gone down, and on exiting the program, does very well. We'll see how things go over the next 12 months. Obviously, a good response, after 3 months is very different to one that you can hold for 12 months, but the signs are very good. The second patient has had their first dosing session up to this point. So what are we now? We're what? It's the 12th of March now. So, 2024. So, they've had their first dosing, and we'll see how that goes. There are similarities, I think, between those and the third patient will start their treatment and is in their preparation phase at the moment, where we're very much working through what the goals of treatment are going to be, planning that out. I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe for your audience's benefit, the typical approach, and this was both with MDMA and psilocybin, is it's psychedelic assisted therapy. So the assisted therapy, the therapy component, is really, really important. And this should be obvious to anyone who just thinks about these drugs. MDMA and psilocybin, there have been hundreds of millions of doses administered to people. In MDMA's case, over the last 30 or 40 years, and psilocybin's case, probably for all of human history. So these are really commonly used drugs that are unique amongst new therapies. I mean, it's an innovative new therapy that is in no way new, So, and that's a huge advantage because we know that they're safe because they've been around a long time, but we also know that they don't work by themselves. Because if they work by themselves, all you'd have to do is go to a dance party, have some MDMA, and then your PTSD would be gone. And we would have picked that up, probably 35 years ago. So clearly there's something more that and the more is the therapy. And so these drugs, offer a way of making therapy more effective, in the case of MDMA, by essentially reducing or blocking the sort of fear filter that people have so that they can actually start to address trauma. In the case of psilocybin, it's much more sort of improving neuroplasticity and essentially switching off your kind of default thinking patterns so you have an opportunity to look at, alternative ways of approaching the same sort of problems. So, that's what you're trying to do. So, and so the therapy ends up being the bigger part of the treatment. So, typically you'll have 3 to 4 preparation sessions with your clinical team, with who are usually psychologists, psychiatrists, nurses. Then you'll have the dosing session, which is a kind of full day, and then you have what's called integration, which is essentially another kind of series of 3 or 4 1-hour therapy sessions with your treating team. And then you repeat that kind of 2 more times. In our current program, there's 3 dosing sessions of MDMA and there's 3 dosing sessions of psilocybin.
The same.
We may change that. I mean, I think that's probably the right number for MDMA with psilocybin. Probably there's more experience having the 2 dosing sessions, so that may be something we look at down the track. But at this stage, that's what it is. So that's what the therapy looks like, and that's going to be absolutely essential. And I think the dosing itself is quite different as well. So people who have had sort of recreational, non-medical use of these drugs, the environment is very different to what's happening in the medical. Typically, MDMA and psilocybin, they're in social events. People are tired. Maybe they're kind of physically exhausted because they've been sort of partying for a bit. There's usually not quite a containing environment. I mean, recreational environments always have a sense of excitement about them, so that's why you take them. And that's not a therapeutic containing environment. That's almost the opposite. And there's obviously a lot of other drug use that goes with it. So for all those reasons, that's very different to the medical. Whereas our sort of the room that we do it in, sort of the where people have their sort of dosing experience, probably the closest analogy that I can think of is like like a birthing suite within a sort of maternity hospital. So obviously it's a medical environment, but we try and soften the whole approach. So it's a slightly bigger room. There are softer furnishings. It's a quieter. The lights are dimmed a bit. You know, it feels a bit different, but ultimately is a medical space. It sits within a medical facility. You know, there's a drug safe, and there is a nurse who helps dispense the medication, and there's all those bits and pieces. So you're not getting a really ugly, bland hospital room, but you're not getting a kind of the forest either. You're not kind of.
Do you think that might shift? I know the approval process, it's not as though you can be outside in the forest, but the environment itself, do you see that might change in time to come, or do you think that that's a big enough
I think look, there's obviously, people have traditionally used these drugs, particularly psilocybin, in very natural outdoor environments. There's a real kind of sense in the sort of community lore about these drugs that, connected them to nature is like a really valuable part of it. And I don't really disagree with that. But having said that, and I do think as time goes on, we'll see a range of kind of ways in which these develop. So from kind of very high end, kind of very expensive clinics in beautiful locations, through to things that have a much more kind of traditional approach and sort of pick up on sort of indigenous themes and indigenous sort of modes of practice for these drugs. I think all of those will have their place. But I do think that, if you want to offer this to a large number of people and give them the benefit of it, there's going to end up being a kind of, I won't use the word generic, but there's going to be a standard approach, which is going to have some simplicity about it. It's probably not going to be in beautiful locations because most people live in urban and suburban areas of major cities. So they're probably going to have to be located not too far from them. They're probably going to be in facilities which have some level of medical accreditation and are able to accommodate staff and clinicians so that we can get the staff there. So I think probably the majority is going to be developed, is going to be more similar to sort of accredited outpatient clinics. And yes, based on the demand from patients in certain groups, there'll be variations to that.
I was just thinking of the I think it was Abu Dhabi or in Dubai. I don't know if anyone's who's listening or if you've been to the airport, but they brought the forest inside. In they've brought the environment, the natural environment inside. So maybe there's something literal. There's literally a forest in the airport. So, but it's quite amazing. Lying on the ground looking at trees, but you're in actually a you're in the airport. So it's not maybe the funding bodies might need to be.
This is it. I mean, to be honest, I mean, having we set up a private hospital kind of 15, 16 years ago and ran it, and some of the things that worked. Mealtime is really important in a private hospital. So we talk about all the therapy programs, but getting the meals right and the community that around people eat their breakfast, lunch, and dinner is absolutely critical. It's not medical. They don't teach you that in medical school. So these sort of things I think are important. And having access to some outside space, I think are really valuable. But I do think one of the biggest challenges we have with psychedelics, which I'm really concerned about, is the cost. And because they are very expensive treatments at the moment, there's out-of-pocket costs for patients in the order of $20,000-$25,000 for a 3-month course of treatment, and I think that's a major issue, and because it's going to limit accessibility. I think the other side of the cost is what it reflects is the complicated model that we're forced to involve, which makes them less scalable. So cost makes patients less able to afford it. But it also reflects the fact that these are so difficult that we're probably less able to offer it as well. That's why the cost's so high, because it's hard to offer. It occurs to me that in a typical sort of MDMA-assisted therapy session, there's probably 80 to 100 hours of specialist clinician involved, whether it's psychiatrist, clinical psychologist. That's where most of the 25,000, 20, 25,000 is going. The drug cost in these treatments, it's quite low. It's like $500 worth of drug cost. So I guess I
Wow.
love.
$500 for dosing for a dose.
For the whole treatment, for three doses over the course. So there's only about $400 or $500 worth of drug costs.
And
Most
everything.
is personnel. So when people talk about ways of making the personnel more special or making the environment more beautiful or larger, or a lot of me kind of thinks, well, bloody hell, that just means it's going to be more expensive. And that's just fewer people that are going to get access to this. And this is not. People with these conditions are not the worried well. They're not looking for a luxury item. These people are often struggling. They don't have money, or their finances have been badly hit by their illness. They're looking for hope, and they're happy to spend money on something that gives them a reasonable, legitimate promise of that. But I think we are sort of obliged, I think, as setting up their service to say, well, what are the must-haves and what are the non-essentials. And let's make this try and get the essence of this treatment as cheaply and as effectively to patients. And I don't want to see patients paying $20,000 or $25,000. I want to start thinking, well, how do we get costs down to half that or less than half that? What does that mean? Does that mean we have one person doing the prep and integration rather than two? Does that mean that we don't necessarily need the second therapist to be an APRA-registered person? They could be someone with a CPAP training or something along those lines. Does that mean we could do some of the stuff in groups? All of these different ideas. We don't know. I don't know the answers to all those, but they're very much top of mind for me in this kind of implementation phase as to, what do we do to actually do this more efficiently? How can we have multiple rooms in the same facility so that we don't need to have one approved, we can have one approved prescriber, supervising four or five treatment sessions. Anything that reduces costs, particularly reduces, and the biggest part of that is anything that uses really rare, expensive personnel more efficiently, anything that does that flows through to lower cost per patient. If you have, yeah.
Do you feel that in terms of the clinicians being the people who are at the moment, going through the CPAP courses and at Mind Medicine as well, in terms of the training, do you see that the approval might expand to people with less, non-clinical at all?
I think that's where we should go. I think you've got, the approved prescriber is a psychiatrist. There's no necessity, I think, for a psychiatrist to be physically in the room for every minute of that 8 hours. A psychiatrist is able to supervise patients in a hospital environment, so they should be able to supervise patients going through this treatment. I think there is, I think, there are two therapists in the dosing sessions. I don't think it's necessary that both of them a kind of clinical psychologist or even psychologist for that matter. I think everyone should have some form of psychedelic training. And I think one of the huge things that Mind Medicine Australia has done is they were kind of forward thinking enough to say, well, we're actually going to need this. So let's start training people in advance. So, as a result of that, we've now got hundreds or even thousands of people that have a CPAP qualification. So we've actually got a cohort of qualified people, not all of whom. I was in the very first cohort of the Certificate of Psychedelic Assisted Therapies run by Mind Medicines, and probably about half the people in that were sort of non-APRA trained people that had an interest in some interest in this and wanted to do sort of counsel and had counseling backgrounds. The other half were kind of your more traditional psychiatrists and clinical psychologists and psychologists. But so there's a I don't think it's required, particularly for that second person, that they do need that. So I do need to be an APRA registered. I think that, and that would certainly reduce the costs and improve the accessibility and the ability to sort of roll out these treatments for patients without actually compromising safety to any great.
Well, I know the safety obviously is such an important factor, especially for people who, as you said, the worried well, people are not just the worried well. It impacts every moment of every day, and that's why the treatment resistant aspect is called treatment resistant for that. But it's unfortunate in a way for the people, the users, because the treatment resistant, there's been so many treatments that people have gone through, and I think that sensitivity to remember is important. Just for our last, I know we need to close soon. I wanted to just almost if you can op envisage perhaps, or maybe it's even your vision of kind of the health system. You know, we're talking about innovations, we've talked about connection in different manners today. And you know, I remember when I was doing my PhD, I mentioned this a lot because it was 1995 to 99, and there were what were called the innovative coordinated care trials. I don't know if you at all remember that, and this was way back when. And it was different ways of fund holding people with people, excuse me, fund holding, so having a certain amount of money for someone with a chronic illness and better using that in the service delivery system. Anyway, it was the, you know, COAG, Council of Australian Government Coordinated Care Trials, and they were looking at worldwide, you know, what systems working for people with chronic illnesses, of which mental health was one of the areas that was looked at, as well as aged care and other chronic diseases. What are your thoughts in terms of kind of the innovations that aren't even here yet, but in terms of almost if you had that blank slate? And I wonder if you can even touch on, I remember it just dawned on me when thinking back to innovations then and now, you know, the even now the mobile support teams that go out from a mental health in the community to keeping them out of institutions, you know, that was the reason coming into the community. And I wonder if, you know, the mobile support teams for psychedelics, or do you, is there anything that kind of comes to you as what your thoughts are for having the history of what innovation in Australia has been, and then what you know internationally and what could be potential if you were, you know, running the show, which you might be, Ted. You never know. You might be running the show. So let's hear it now. No, no, I'm being kind of tongue in cheek, but I mean it in I'm a serious question.
And I think it's really serious because I mean, there's and again, there's a ways of looking at this. I think the future of mental health care is in coordinated outpatient care for patients. I think that is the future. I think of, you know, I think it goes to the functional view I have that keeping people in their home and in the community is absolutely critical. It becomes consistent for people because you can often deliver that care over, you know, 6, 12, 18 months, longer periods of time, which is kind of much better than these short, intermittent bursts of treatment. I think that actually is where the innovation is. You know, I look at all the innovative new treatments, you know, psychedelic therapy, you know, TMS, TDCS, esketamine, oral care, all these are outpatient treatments. So interventional outpatient treatment is actually where the innovation in is. These are not, I'm not hearing any kind of brand new kind of overnight hospital. You need to be in a hospital for 2 weeks and they do a procedure on you and then you're cured. None of that. There's none of that out there. Even if it could be, it isn't. Now, so that's where I think the future is. Unfortunately, our funding formula in Australia really isn't coping with coordinated outpatient care. There is no funding model. The way mental health care is funded is you can have outpatient care with as a doctor or a psychologist, and that's individual appointments funded by, you know, supported by Medicare, as long as the individual doctor is doing it by themselves. And other than that, and most of that isn't even properly funded because there's such a shortage of those professionals who essentially work by themselves or in little cottage industry type factories. There's such a small number of those people, they kind of charge what they want. So, you know, it's essentially paid for by patients and delivered in a disorganized sort of community way. At the other end of the spectrum, you've got hospital care. You know, the way we fund hospital care, essentially the you know, schizophrenia and acute self-harm is funded by the public hospital systems in every state, and chronic mental health, depression, anxiety is funded by the private health insurance funds. And the model of care that the only and funding only attaches to a night in bed. You know, when I used to run a private hospital, we got paid for the number of people that were in bed at midnight on that day. So if someone wasn't in their bed at midnight, you got no money. So you can see how that sort of warps the system. You know, you basically have to keep a patient, make sure they're back. So even things like leave policies, you know, private hospitals would give day leave, but they would expect that people would be back by 8 or 10 o'clock at night. That was not a mistake. People with 3 week admissions were the norm. You know why? Because at the end of 3 weeks, the step down daily rate starts to drop dramatically from, whatever it was. It might be, once you get to the 22-day mark, it starts to become, a third or a half of that number. So people get discharged and get replaced with someone else. So these kind of funding formulas mean that we kind of have to start to think about that. Now, the good news is that we are starting to think about that. There was an article in The Australian yesterday about the mental health bed crisis, that's out there, and sort of private hospital groups, governments are now starting to take seriously the idea of outpatient treatments. We saw that with magnetic stimulation treatment when they created the Medicare item number to offer this treatment, which is essentially a daily treatment delivered as an outpatient in a model. So that was a step in the right direction. There was not perfect. And we're inevitably going to see this with psychedelic assisted therapy. We had our first patient where we had full funding through an insurance company for their treatment. Unfortunately, they weren't suitable. So we had the funding, but they didn't meet our criteria. I've heard that in Perth, there's a veterans group, a charity that's funding veterans having psychedelic assisted therapy. At some point, we may even see insurance companies come on board to fund this. So I think these models need to be thought of, but I don't think the answers are simple. If you talk to insurance companies, as I have, I've talked about outpatient treatment. So, I remember having a discussion with Medibank. And I said, well, we've got this treatment. At that stage, it was magnetic stimulation, but you could apply the same for psilocybin. And if we treat this patient, they probably aren't going to need to go to hospital. And that's going to save you a lot of money because this patient's going to hospital, twice a year at $25,000 a pop. That'll save you a lot of money. And they say, but Ted, we love it. But the truth is, we know what these hospitals are like. If you fix one patient that goes to a hospital bed, they'll just find another one to put in there. So in essence, you're not asking us to save money. You're asking us to give you money to do something that, and we'll still end up being on the hook for the price of the hospital. So
Yeah,
that,
it's an
and that's the problem.
interesting. Yeah, what do you say to that? And like, it's an interesting funding model.
So we need to think about the whole big picture of funding. One of the models that does work in Adelaide, they have a because it's such a Adelaide's a very small pool of people and they're quite geographically isolated. The various hospitals essentially fund patient care, both inpatient and outpatient, because they can, because the patients can't go elsewhere. There are only a finite number of people. It doesn't and that kind of works for that area. Probably wouldn't work in a place like Sydney or Melbourne, but does work there. But I do think the challenges that we need is how do we fund outpatient coordinated care? How do we fund hospital style treatment that doesn't involve a night in bed?
Yeah.
But does involve, clinical governance, safety, emergency access, psychiatrists, nurses, psychologists all working as a team. You can't do that, in the current model of care, unless you're in a bed in a hospital.
Well, I know that I could have conversation, for the next hours and hours in terms of that. I think, I don't know if there's any final things that perhaps anything else that you would like listeners to understand about the treatment or your thoughts or anything that I haven't covered. And I guess I wonder, it's that I think her name's Carol Tui. It was I think it's a Canadian woman who researcher in health service systems, and talked about incidental. Most of the things that change as innovation are incidental steps, not big, big bang things. Even like the establishment of Medicare or the big things. Usually, it's kind of incidental, incremental. More to the point, incremental steps. But in this emergency, so as you say, and as someone who ex has experienced it myself as a client and a citizen of this country as well as America, the big bang, there is an emergency, and you wonder if there, we talked about the diagnostic manuals and so forth that was really done for insurance purposes, not necessarily just the diagnostic aspect. So is there anything you have to, want to say on record? No, I'm joking. Anything you'd like to say around the diagnostic manual, et cetera? Do you see that there could be some other type of classification system? Is anyone talking about that? Or maybe pointing to just as someone, someone near and dear to me who lives in this country, who isn't my family member, but has four diagnoses, the multiple, the multi-diagnosing that, goes on. Anything around that?
I mean, as I said, I just sort of draw you back to what I said about function. I mean, I think if our starting point for patients is function, our assessment is function, and our measure for success is around function, I think we're mostly going to get it right. In that sense, diagnosis sort of becomes secondary. It's an important secondary, and you do have to go through the process and work through it. And I think it keeps clinicians on their toes because they're forced to justify themselves. If you're saying, this, you've got to have, at least have some kind of hypothesis that you've developed yourself as to why you've come up with that diagnosis. But ultimately, function is what matters. So the most important thing in mental health, I think, is function. If that's your starting point, then you'll do okay. And if in terms of the practice of mental health care, imbuing hope, particularly in mental health care, where kind of hopelessness is such an integral part of the experience of mental health issues. Being able to imbue hope is really important. And a big part of hope is options. So, we shouldn't be narrowing down options. We should be opening up options. And that, I think, is probably the most valuable thing we can do. And I hope we don't stop with, for me, it's not about, stopping with psychedelic therapy. I think I want to see that as an option for patients and for clinicians. And I want to see more stuff as well. I want to see innovation continuing because I do think it's incremental. And I don't think any of the things we've talked about today are going to solve all the problem. I think we're going to need more innovation.
Well, thank you so much for coming to at this point where you are one of the first providing this therapy, approved therapy in Australia. And I hope that perhaps maybe in the next, 6 to 12 months, another conversation, just as I think that being open as you have been, and to thank you very much for, being honest around everything that you have shared, and also though, not giving up hope yourself, and as you started that purposeful work that you're doing, and the multidisciplinary aspect and the options for accessibility, especially people who are, rural, where it's not, where these treatments aren't accessible, and the accessibility to that. I know Mind Medicine Australia has a patient fund that people that goes directly to patient funding. Should they be able, should they get through the screening process, et cetera. So I know that that's only one, but an important funding model, and really being innovative in our funding models as well. So thank you for answering openly and candidly. And I think a lot of people will be very interested in just the issues that we're bringing up, which aren't new, are they? But that there can be continued innovation, and we don't stop, because I think when we sit idle, that is, the problem, a challenge. And although you did talk about this at the beginning of the of this interview, you talked about the doing, the function, and the doing, and obviously that productivity and the doing function can be, it's not just a productivity at work. And you did say this, and I'm just seconding it really, but you can, having your own self-inquiry and doing your own internal landscape work, as well as how you work with the external environment, is also functional. So it's not though, your time off, on and off at work, sometimes that can be a very much an issue in itself. So I know that Yeah, just that functional in the broadest sense, so that we hopefully make a real dent in some of these statistics. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Deborah. I'm very happy to do this again sometime.
Thanks.
Okay.